Good morning and welcome to MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue and we're coming to you from the campus of Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro, Tennessee. Humans in Crisis International Corporation is a charitable organization co-founded by Dr. Hari Garbaran, professor of geosciences at MTSU, and his wife Hina. The idea is to help communities in other countries help themselves with educational assistance, among other things. And to fund this assistance, student members at MTSU have designed Campaign One, a drive to pay for help for two rural villages in Nepal. And with us today to talk about it are Dr. Hari Garbaran, also Jason Goodrich, a student from Nashville and Director of Finance and Accounting for Humans in Crisis, Mary Lane Poe, a student from Murfreesboro and the group's Planning and Operations Coordinator, Laura R. Collins, who is an instructor of geosciences and an MTSU alumna, and Shaparak Malik, who is a graduate student majoring in sociology from Nashville and a member of the group. Welcome, one and all.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Hari, what inspired you and your wife to begin this organization?
Yeah, actually, when we had first come to MTSU, right, Jenna, we had won an MTSU grant. That was way back in like 1999. Mm-hmm. And I am originally from South Africa. Mm-hmm. And so we won a USAID grant, and I directed the research there. We worked in Zulu, Zulu squatter communities out in KwaZulu-Natal. Mm-hmm. And it was a 3-year grant, worked from 1999 to 2002. Mm-hmm. Worked mainly with the women and the female, just adolescents and girls out there as well. And when we left in 2002, we wanted to sustain this project, as it were. And one of the things that happened was that there were a number of folks dying of HIV/AIDS in South Africa. And so a lot of orphan kids became, a lot of kids were orphaned, actually, to infect parents with HIV/AIDS. So that's the first thing that triggered it off. And then we decided, let's start something. Because my wife asked me, so now what are you going to do? That's the first thing she asked. So that's when I started. I filed for a 501c3 through the IRS, and Humans in Crisis was born in 2003. And that's how it started. And then in 2008, St. Jason came over. Of course, he was at MTSU, but I just had him in class. And I guess that's when he took a new face, because Jason was right there next to me. And I had a helping hand, and not only that, but he's been so great to work with that we started moving into just moving it forward straight towards MTSU. And I should add that just before he had come, though, we did have Laura. Laura was in 2006. She and I talked about how can we spread our wings at MTSU. And since we were not at that time a recognized 501c3 organization, because it takes 5 years before the IRS really gives you the go-ahead.
Were you a recognized student organization?
No.
By the university?
No. In fact, even that, of course, Jason will talk more about that. Mm-hmm. Because he had founded that as well. So that's how it all came about.
How did you make the transition from helping South Africans to helping the Nepalese?
Yeah, well, we first started with helping, the African kids. And then we also, from there, we also went to India. We had taken it to India as well. And in 2006, we went to Hyderabad. And that's in Andhra Pradesh, in India. And we worked with an orphanage out there where there are 50 girls. And it's a Hyderabad Baptist Trust organization. So that took us to India. And, of course, previously I had taken our students on field trips to India and Nepal and, of course, to South Africa as well. So I had always wanted to expand the work that, the work that we do with things like poverty and so on in Africa and in India. And then I should say that Jason also was the one that expanded it to us in Nepal. He was the one that did that.
Jason, this is not your common garden variety student organization, bake sale type organization, right. Not to be disparaging of others, but these are the big ticket items. These are huge issues. Do you look at the degree of work to be done, even though you're helping one village at a time, as it were, and find the whole thing rather daunting because you're talking about extreme levels of poverty in these regions?
That's true. It is daunting. It's a challenge. Personally, I like challenges. Mm-hmm. I like that overcoming obstacles part of it. And I don't think that these are issues, because they are large, that should be really not necessarily, I don't want to say dismissed, but we shouldn't be too scared to look at them and deal with them. No matter what our station in society, whether a student or a member of faculty or a small business owner. And these issues don't necessarily, they're not necessarily limited to the developing world. We can look in our own cities. Although not at such levels as in other countries, but these are things that efforts can be made. And I think there's a awareness problem. Mm-hmm. I think it's two parts. I think it's one that people aren't aware, and I think the other is that people that are aware choose to ignore. And I think that we can do better.
Mm. Laura, in the developing world, of all the needs, what is the most pressing? Does it start with education, or does it start with subsistence level survival?
Survival is the basics. Our main goal was to try to give them school supplies. With the orphans in Hyderabad, India, you know, they were sleeping on boards, basically, with a blanket, and they had maybe two pairs of clothes, and that was it. And it was, firstly, is to try to get the basics, the food, the shelter, what we can, because shelter can be very expensive, but also school supplies. And that's one of their goals, is to do what we call school to school, and trying to get school children here in Murfreesboro to start pen pals, trying to write these children, not in Nepal, but hopefully India and South Africa and things like that, and help them with their English, but also to show the children here in Murfreesboro how life is very different for those at below, you know, poverty level, who have barely the essentials to live. So it is the basic essentials first. And then hopefully one day we can build on that.
To what extent are the children to whom the Murfreesboro kids write literate in English or conversant in English?
I'm sorry, I didn't understand.
To the pen pals, mm-hmm. to whom the Murfreesboro children are writing, to what extent can they understand the English language?
I'm not sure. We're still working on that as far as...
It hasn't been. We haven't rolled it out yet. Okay. The English is taught in the schools, in the public schools of Nepal. With these two villages that we're working with, there's a particular challenge, though, because of the language barrier. Many of these, they speak Tulung, and they... Tulung Rai is... I think that Tamang, I think, is the other language. But you have some cases. You have those languages are not; they're only oral, mm-hmm. and so there are no written components. And as they come into grade school, they don't have a kindergarten, so they start with class one. They go in. The language of instruction is Nepali, mm-hmm. so they actually have to learn Nepali at the same time they're learning English, mm-hmm. And so it's a pretty good challenge for those students. And because of the remote location, you don't have someone who's properly, as we would have here, certified, mm-hmm. to teach English. The blind leading the blind in some senses. Mm-hmm. So,
Shap, what attracted you to Humans in Crisis more than any other aspect of the organization?
Well, I've always had an interest in nonprofit work. Prior to even, you know, meeting Hari as my professor, I'd worked at a local nonprofit, the National Conference for Community and Justice, for about 3 years. So I've always had a interest in that. And, you know, when I met with Hari about the organization, it was mainly just doing the outreach and helping the children that are overseas. My primary goal is to help get grants and funding to get the programs that Jason and Hari were trying to implement. I mean, that's basically what my fundamental goal and initiative here is.
Finding a grant and finding just the right grant and applying for it and knowing, navigating your way around that whole bureaucratic process is really, really complicated. It's good to have somebody with experience in that area working with you.
It is, and I believe in the mission that they do have with the organization, and that's initially what attracted me to it, and then on top of the nonprofit work which I've done, which I always have a strong passion for, I really enjoy it. Mm-hmm. So it's putting your education and your knowledge towards something that's a better good, you know. So,
Mary Lane, I know you from your work with Dr. Doug Heffington of Global Studies in his Rural Settlement class, and you also involved with the new Women's Studies Student organization. What convinced you to carve out a chunk of time out of your very busy student schedule for this organization?
Well, the initial thing that drew me to the organization was personal experience. As an international relations major, I've always said I was going to work with a nonprofit, but I didn't really realize what all that entailed. So when I was approached by Professor Hari getting involved with this program, I thought that would be a great way to kind of learn the ins and outs of how a nonprofit worked. And over time, now that I've gotten to know Professor Hari and Jason and gotten to know the programs, I really have gotten some good experience in trying to deal with fundraising and membership and organization and just, like I said, the ins and outs of how the program works.
Hari, what are some of the NGOs that you partner with, and how do those relationships work?
Yeah, there too, like we have got the Mountain Fund, for example, in Nepal, and they have got, I mean, the entire, in fact, infrastructure in Nepal. I was just talking with Jason about that because he was the one that went to Nepal, really, and that had started this link with the Mountain Fund. But they have got their hands in just about everything. If you go to their website, you see them. They're involved in poverty reduction, you name it. If it is education, they now have an aid school for children. They are in health, every aspect of health, be it with doctors or be it with nurses. And so that is one of the organizations. But then I have been also involved with so many other African nonprofit organizations or the NGOs that I have worked with when I was in South Africa from 1999 to 2002. And there are so many of them out there, Jenna, and they are waiting to hook up with an American organization as well. You know, it's, I guess, see, part of the reason is because they are looking for international help, number one, but also they're also looking for some guidance too. And they feel that that we have that extra something where they can work with us, they can just partner with us, get the guidance, and also, you know, sort of move forward. So I have written, for example, with agencies in Lesotho, in Swaziland, for the poor especially. And although we haven't won any grants as yet, but we are on our way. I'm very confident that very soon we will be able to attract some grants. What we are really trying to do really is trying to raise some money. That is really what we're trying to do, because even if you write grants, even if you want to join other NGOs, you have to match a certain amount of funding. Normally, you have to have at least 25% matching funds.
This is what Campaign One is all about.
That's what Campaign One is. One of the things that we have started, because that $1 that we are talking about pays a teacher in Nepal for 2 days. That $1 goes such a long way in a place like Nepal that we need all the help we can get.
Had any of you ever worked on a PR campaign before? No, not exactly. With the state of the American and world economy and the situation that it is, how do you get people's attention at a time when so many people are losing their jobs and are fixated on their own survival?
And I think a good answer to that is actually based in Maryland, and her friend. Do you want to see what you all did the other day?
Yeah, we actually had some success a couple weeks ago, myself and Becca Wilson, another one of our members. Just standing out in the BAS, we had a box with our flyers on it. And as people came by, we simply asked, do you have any spare change? Do you have any nickels? Do you have any quarters floating around in your pockets? And I found that that was very successful. I think we raised about $60, and we were just out there for 2 hours. But you'll find that, that students especially want to help. They're inclined to help these different causes. They don't necessarily have a lot of money to give, though, so just asking for spare change can really add up if you're in a good location.
Convenience is a factor, too. If you can just give and go,
that
makes it easy, right?
And we handed out our flyers for people that wanted to know more about us. We were happy to tell where their money was going. But some people just walked by and pulled a dollar out of their wallet, or some people even gave $5 bills. So it's amazing what just a little bit can do to help, because $60, I mean, that's...
It goes so much farther over there than it does over here.
It is a different world. In contrast to our own, it is very different, but not necessarily a bad different. There are amazing cultures there, and its location, just it's sandwiched right there. It's I think about the size I read somewhere, roughly the size of the state of Arkansas. So in terms of land. But with the terrain sandwiched between India.
You're in the Himalayas, right?
You are in the Himalayas. Between India and Nepal, India and China, you have an amazing array of cultures that have historically come through. You have Central Asian influences. You have Mongolian. Chinese influences, Indian. When you step off the plane, you normally will have come most likely from Delhi or Calcutta or Mumbai. So you probably by then have already gotten accustomed to the smog and the pollution in the air. But if you haven't, you soon will. It took me a day or two of coughing to sort of get acclimated.
Do you like that canopy that hangs over the Great Smoky Mountains National Park?
It is. I was fortunate enough to go this spring, and I was there for 28 days. While I was there, I saw the blue sky once in all the time there, just because of that layer. And it was simply because it rained. It hadn't rained the entire time I was there. And it was nice to see color, because when you're there, everything is drab. Everything is a gray or a brown. There's really not the green is just dirty. It's dusty. And as for the Nepal, it has been in has been recovering from a 10-year insurgency, civil war, and this internal struggle has depleted a lot of resources. It's caused some difficulties with the government actually being able to run the country, lack of infrastructure, and now it's a bit of a precarious time, at least for those who are in power, because you have a coalition government. And so it's a little bit more difficult, some say, to get things done. Others have found, the Mountain Fund, Scott McClellan, McLennan, he's the director who started the Mountain Fund. Lives in New Mexico, but he has spent about 8 years. One of the 75 districts in Nepal. He has brought one hospital and three health clinics online. In one district that services 45,000 people, and he had to do it with the support of the Maoist controlled coalition, and was able to do it. Where in several years ago, he couldn't get any headway at all. So in some ways it's good, in some ways it's bad. But the poverty is still there,
right.
And that's the most significant problem that's really hurting their development.
Well, the climate you described sounds like it would make agriculture quite difficult. What about the political situation that you mentioned coming off the insurgency? How stable or tenuous is the peace?
When I was there, it was right before Pachanda, the prime minister, stepped down. Everyone's vying for a piece of the puzzle, and I won't pretend to be an expert on the politics of Nepal. In fact, when I went there, I knew practically little to nothing about Nepal, which was a good opportunity for me because I have really since then become immersed in the country.
It's all about learning yourself. It's not just about teaching others.
Absolutely, absolutely. In fact, when I went, I sort of incorporated finding partners for this organization while also satisfying a component of my degree. I actually, along with Mary Lane, have been a global studies minor and went there to satisfy that. Mm-hmm. That study abroad component. To get back to your question, though, the what makes the situation there worse is that you have severe droughts followed by severe flooding. And while I was there, we had the major dam that provides the electricity mm-hmm. had been knocked out about 4 months before, and so we had to do load shedding. We had 8 hours of power a day, mm-hmm. 4 hours in the morning. 4 hours in the evening, and then it rotated based on where you were. So the amount of work that's actually done is pretty limited, too.
Okay. One of the things that I find particularly interesting about Humans in Crisis is that there are what are described on your website as Women's Foundation programs, and it seems like there's been an increasing interest in helping women all over the world, helped out by Secretary of State Clinton in her trip to Africa and so forth. Talk a little bit about assisting women.
Well, in the global South. In the global South, most oftentimes is the case, women have less rights. They have less power over their own lives, less control. In Nepal, I have never experienced this before. I mean, I guess what we take for granted here, but I didn't realize that women there have no rights until they are either married or their father bestows rights on them culturally. So the education. And the education system there does not emphasize the role of women in the classroom mm-hmm. to learn. And so the development, again, for women to be able to become empowered, mm-hmm. That is, it's sad. Because when I went there, and I went to the Women's Foundation, I went to their shelter, and I saw these stories and looked at these photographs of women who are abused, and the men, and this is severe beatings, and they're women who have been killed. The women in the shelter, their husbands come looking for them. Mm-hmm. And to see them there and their children, it's heartbreaking to realize they can't help themselves because of the strictures in place by their own society. And it's troubling.
Marilyn?
Just your original question about why there's been kind of a trend from NGOs towards helping women. Mm-hmm. I'm a women's studies minor.
Right.
And we've discussed in some of my classes how that cultural and sexual revolution of the 1960s worldwide really kind of catapulted a worldwide trend by women to kind of stand up and try and demand rights. And that's really kind of how it started back in the 60s and 70s, that worldwide cultural, again, sexual revolution really took off and kind of started in America and, you know, or not America, but in the Western countries, and has kind of seeped down. The women in the third world are finally starting to realize that this doesn't have to be just something that these women in America and Britain and places like that can achieve. You know, they're starting to realize that they have rights and they can stand up for themselves too. So I think a lot of NGOs have kind of gotten on that train and wanted to help the women.
Jeff, when you talk to your fellow students, do you find that there's more of an international or global mindset among today's college students as opposed to just thinking provincially, domestically about what's right here in front of them, being thinking of themselves, you know, not almost exclusively as an American, but not as an American, more as an American and a citizen of the world?
I would agree so, and I think so. I think because students today have a lot more access to the global community. It's at our fingertips, with just the click of a finger, and you can access so many things. And I think that that's something that generations past did not have that. And that's something that is enabled students to, I guess, broaden their horizons in terms of seeing what's going on globally, and also broaden their horizons in terms of goals and aspirations for themselves. To in terms of aid, you know, different organizations they might want to partner with or intern with, and things that, you know, I guess because in the past most of the time it was a lot more domestic, and you see things that are right there around you, or you have to, you know, that's the access that you have. But when it's right at your fingertips and you can see pretty much the whole world in front of you, it just gives you a broader picture of things.
Do you see the same thing in your interactions with your students, Laura? Of course, you teach geosciences, so you presumably people wouldn't be in your class unless they were interested in a global perspective. But how does it compare to, say, when you were going to college? Has it increased?
First of all, I teach earth science, so it's not really a lot about, it's more like the earth itself versus human interactions,
right,
for environmental, of course. Be honest with you, I don't think a lot has changed. I think the focus has shifted on what's going on in the world, basically. When we talk about women's rights and things, I think we are shifting more towards that because, you know, men used to always be the one to make the money and take care, you know, the families and stuff. We now know that, you know, women have, especially those who are single mothers throughout the world, we've got to step forth and try to make it equal for everyone, no matter what their sex, race, or religion is. In my classes, though, it's not, it's basically just science or science, so it's hard to see this connected with that.
Right. Hari, if people want to know more about Humans in Crisis, how do they get in contact?
Yes, they just go to their website that we've got, www.hicic.org, and they could email us at secretary.hickey, or, in fact, president@hickey.org, right? And of course, our doors are always open. We are looking for some volunteers, and really, we're looking for money as well. We're really looking for in fact, money, Jenna, because we have so much to do. We have the RAND project, okay, our Rural Assistance Nepal project, mm-hmm, where we're trying to raise $4,800. We're almost halfway through, and our goal was December 2009 to get that done. And I think we can do it. I think that I trust the Murfreesboro community, the Nashville community, and I know we can do this. So I think number one thing would be to go on our website. We got the Infect PayPal system set up, and as you say nowadays, it's just a click of your hand. Mm-hmm. With the click of your hand, you can go ahead and make a contribution. Plus, it is tax deductible. Mm-hmm. We are a certified 501c3 organization.
HICIC.org, Humans in Crisis. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
This is MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue. Please join us again at the same time next Sunday, 8 a.m. Don't forget, we're also available on mtsunews.com and iTunes.